COTA just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your COTA fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with COTA. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Welcome to the Your Favorite Band Podcast, a podcast where we talk to your favorite bands about how your favorite bands became your favorite bands. I'm Bran, and with me, as usual, is co-host Dave. I'm saying co-host Dave today because there's another Dave on the line. But co-host Dave, how are you?
I'm doing good. Co-host Bran.
Look, I mean, I'm the only Bran, so you don't need to do that.
But you're not the only co-host, so kind
of. That's true. No, great. All of these are a really good point. We're really excited today. Dave, I don't know if you remember this. The first show we ever played together, we covered this band. It was our first cover song that we did. And this was the band we covered. Do you remember that? It was awful.
I didn't even actually think about that until you just now said it, but that's quite funny now.
Yeah. So we're really happy to be talking to May today. Dave, from May, how are you doing, man?
I'm awesome, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How does that make you feel to know that we did a really crappy job of presenting your music to the world?
Well, the way that you just presented it, I don't know how to feel, but tell me what song you played and how long ago you did this.
It was, a solid 8 years ago, Dave?
Was that long? Jeez.
It was a while ago. And then, what was it, Suspension?
I think it was Suspension.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
cool. So yeah. Was it really not that good, or are you just being modest?
It was literally our first show, and we like just threw it together at the last second.
I forgot that was our first show. That's so funny. Yeah, and you know what? Was that the same show that we were going to try and do some songs from The Wizard of Oz?
Yeah, we were going to do that too. Listen, enough about us. Let's talk about May.
You brought it up, Bran.
I'm sorry.
Bold.
Well, we're excited. We're going to talk about May and how May has been around for a little while, and so there's a lot to get to. But let's go a little bit before May. Talk about what you were up to and what the band was up to before May started and how you guys kind of found each other.
Oh, wow. Well, it's November 2016, and May was definitely recording what was to become our first record, Destination Beautiful, 15 years ago.
Wow.
I graduated from high school in the year 2000. And I went to Old Dominion University for college after that, which is where I met Jacob Marshall, our drummer. May stands for Multisensory Aesthetic Experience. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't know that. But Jacob, when I met him, he had developed his own major through interdisciplinary studies. And so he was studying aesthetic theory, why people perceive beauty the way they do, the relationship between color and sound. He was interviewing people that had perfect pitch and synesthesia. He'd play a musical piece for them and ask them what colors they were seeing in their minds. And independently of each other, they were seeing the same color scheme. So I was just like really intrigued by his passion for that. And I was just an avid music lover. So I dropped out of school a year and a half in, and I moved to LA and took a sort of a break from May as we were slowly getting started to be a hired gun musician for this artist named Kenna. And Kenna was produced by the Neptunes, like Pharrell from Happy and The Voice. And
Pharrell from Pharrell. And,
exactly. And they're from Virginia Beach, that production team, as was this guy, Kenna. So I went out there, and our first shows as a 19 or 20-year-old, I was opening up for No Doubt.
Nice.
And played bass, played a little bit of keys, and a little bit of guitar. and sang backup, and the music was really intricate. And I saw the drummer that he hired get fired the first week I was there, and so it meant two things: that the musicality of the project was really involved, and I did not want to come back home and you know, sort of be defeated,
right,
not being able to kind of carry my weight. And so I would just go back to the hotel every night, and I'd keep practicing and keep practicing, and it worked out. And that was like the moment where I realized that I was capable of having a sustainable career in the music industry if I could write songs that I believed in, that I thought were good enough for other people to get behind. And so I went out to LA another time and kept playing with Kenna, and in between trips I'd come home and we would get in the studio, Maywood, and work on what would become Destination Beautiful. So that was 02. And in November of 2002, we signed our first recording contract with Tooth & Nail Records.
Yeah.
And Destination Beautiful came out the night before my 21st birthday.
Wow.
On February 25th, 2003.
Happy birthday.
And yeah, back then, that was absolutely the best day of my life.
Yeah.
Going to a show in Dallas, which actually was snowed out, so we didn't get to perform, but we were officially on tour and had been on tour for since January. So we'd been on tour for about 6 weeks at that point, and we ended up playing over 300 shows just that year. And I mean, the band has probably played, honestly, I'd guess between like 1,500 and 2,000 shows at this point. I'd have to ask our booking agent for the actual numbers. But yeah, that was just like the most exciting time for, you know, a 19, 20, and then 21-year-old kid. Dropping out of school, I definitely had the support of my parents and my entire family and friends.
Yeah.
Everybody kind of felt like May was going to be successful, or, you know, just get an opportunity, and it would, you know, be what we made of it for sure. But it was a really exciting time to be a teenager and a very young adult and be on the road, traveling, playing music nonstop.
Yeah.
So when you guys released that first album, what was the kind of the goal with that, being that you had such a specific inspiration in naming your band Multisensory Aesthetic Experience? Did you guys try and tie that into with what you were doing with your shows and stuff like that at that point?
At that point, no. We were the opening band. You know, we were main support of a three-band bill, or the second band out of four, and we were probably getting paid like $100 a night, maybe at the most like $200-$250 a night. And at that point, May was a five-member band, and of course we had like a tiny little crew that of our friends that came out and would tour manage and sell merch for us and run sound. And so we put all of our income, you know, from getting paid to play the shows and to sell t-shirts and stuff like that, right back into the machine of the touring machine, really just making sure that we could put gas in the van. And at that point we were sleeping on floors pretty often. So it took a while for us to graduate to the acronym. We started implementing more of that in the coming years, you know, and it took probably about 4 or 5 years before we were really getting into the multisensory experience of our shows. But it was always something that we were just waiting for the right opportunity and wanting to make sure that if it was sort of this DIY style that we were putting a multisensory experience together within like a club show, that it was well worth you know, the people who would buy tickets and come see us, and for us, like, something that we would be proud of once we, you know, looked out and saw the crowd sort of experiencing what we would do. I remember in 2009, we were on tour promoting the Afternoon EP, one of the three EPs that we put out that year, and when you would walk into the venue, you'd come to our table, our merch table, and we'd hand you a pair of 3D glasses. And by the time we're playing, there's projection, video projection on screens, on stage during our performance. And during this one song called The Fight Song, there's this long guitar solo. And right before the guitar solo starts, the video tells you, put on your 3D glasses. And a storm is sort of erupting, and a tornado cloud is coming at you. And we brought a bunch of high-powered industrial fans with us. And we had our group of Mayteamers, and we'd hand them out secretly about 50 or so spray water bottles, like kind of the ones that when you get a haircut, the barber wets your hair with. And when 50 people do that in a room and you have these fans going, if you're unaware, all of a sudden it's raining, it's windy, a tornado is coming at you in the room, and
that's
coincidentally
so awesome.
If you bought a tour only version of afternoon or morning, afternoon or evening, the top of the CD was sort of the same as like scratch and sniff stickers, even though it wasn't that. It was a lot more pro than that. But so you'd put the disc in your car that night if you wanted to listen to it, and when you took it out, like, your car would smell like, for evening, that was wintertime, so it smelled like firewood.
Oh.
And afternoon, I can't remember what afternoon was, but it all corresponded to, like, the lyrics and the songs and,
Dude,
sort of the overarching concept of...
Do you have any of those evening ones left over you can send me? Because that sounds delightful.
You know, I don't. Those were tour-only editions. I think we only printed about 2,500 or so for each tour that we did. So we sold out of those pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I do have... I do have, like, my own sort of, for... that I'm collecting for myself.
Yeah, perfect.
But
send that one to him.
Send that right on over.
That's so cool. I actually went on that tour, but I had no idea that that was one of the things. I was at the house of, this was the Social in Orlando.
Okay. Yeah. I remember that tour very well.
That was so cool. Was that just cool? Like, did that just work out perfectly that you ended up being able to do a morning, afternoon, evening, good night? Or was that something that you guys kind of already thought about when you were, like, way earlier on? About the morning, afternoon, evening thing.
Yeah, the story about that sort of comes out of a little bit of band tragedy. Back in 07, we were on Capitol Records, and we put out an album called Singularity. And right as we were getting our final mixes and masters for that album, the label sort of imploded, and about 90% of the staff that was Capitol Records were all fired. And so when it came time for us to find out how our record was going to be marketed and what the label was going to do, to sort of promote our first release on Capitol, there was just no money to spend, and there was no staff left over who was willing to champion our band. And so it was a really tough time. I remember being on the road on that tour specifically, and it wasn't a very good turnout across the country.
Hmm.
And so we would talk to our A&R at Capitol, and he'd say, well, there's just no money for us to spend right now to print posters and mail them to the cities and the venues that you're playing. And so I was like, wow, so we're finally on this major label. We made our first record for free. We made our second record for $80,000, and we made this record, and you had to spend like $800,000, but there's no money to just make sure people know that we're on tour now. It was a really difficult time.
Yeah.
And the band was sort of going through individually, just sort of changes. Two of the guys in the band got married that year, and we're really wanting to spend time at home. And then once the label imploded and there wasn't any proof of recovery, our keyboard player and our bass player left the band. We ended up parting ways with our manager, and we really needed to figure out why the three of us were going to continue. And we've always been extremely passionate about music and songwriting and that relationship between us and our listeners. But it was really difficult that season. So we hid away for a little while and started writing new music. And that was extremely inspiring, and we decided that the way we were going to do things moving forward was by sort of re-envisioning what success was for us. And instead of it being based on how many records we were selling or what the label thought of us or tickets at venues, we decided that we were going to sell our music directly from our website. And this is back in, you know, January of 2009 is when this whole campaign started. So yeah. This is kind of before the crowdfunding websites like Kickstarter and Indiegogo, et cetera. And bands like Radiohead and Nine Inch Nails had already done their direct-to-fan release relationship, and that was inspiring to us. So we did that, and we took all of the money that we made from our digital sales and partnered up with specific charities and started like giving back to the communities that had been taking care of us and uplifting us over the years. And so that was really where we figured out how the next phase of May was going to be, I guess, like inspirational for us. Yeah. And but with that came a lot of hard work because we were managing ourselves. We started our own label to put out this music and really did things more in-house than we ever had before. Yeah. So after the morning, afternoon, and evening tours and releases and campaigns, we were pretty burnt out. And we kind of knew going into it that we were taking on a heavy task and wanted to see it through, but also we were looking forward to a considerable resting period once all that was done. So I think we foresaw some of it, and of course a lot of it was just you know, on the fly, some decisions we were making. But we had a firm grasp on how we wanted to deliver music and reach people in 2009 and 2010 for sure.
Yeah. So kind of to kind of get to where we are now, I want to go back and kind of walk through the musical and lyrical growth of the band. So even going back to Destination Beautiful, with your first album, as a band, what were you guys hoping to be the first thing that people heard when they heard May? What were you guys shooting for with that album as a kind of your jumping into the world, here's our band type thing?
That's a good question. I don't think anyone's ever asked that before. You know, I was a kid. I was so passionate about music. I was only lead singing and songwriting in my second band as May at this point. I was a drummer in my first band when I was a kid.
Okay.
I played bass in my second band and then started playing guitar and singing some backup in my third band. And then my fourth band, I was lead singing, playing guitar, and then May was my fifth. So I was really just, I was still really young, really new as a songwriter, lyrically especially. And, you know, I'm, like I said, I graduated from high school in 2000. So in the late 90s, I think before emo was a word that, or a label that some bands didn't want to use or what didn't want to have as a label for their music, I was really excited about this sort of newly discovered genre for me where it didn't necessarily matter about how many times you sang the chorus. It didn't necessarily matter lyrically, you know, how strong the hook was. It was about self-expression. It was about the emotive characters of the chord changes and the dynamics and the melodies. And yet, they were calling bands like Jimmy Eat World when Clarity came out, they were calling that an emo record. And that's as catchy and as melodic and as beautiful as like a pop rock emo record could be. And I was really just sort of diving into that, especially when I met Jacob in college. So he was, you know, really into aesthetic theory and the senses, and I was into the way music was just moving my senses and moving my emotions.
Right.
And so I was just kind of writing from the heart, writing from experience. And I remember back then, the way I would write a new song is I would just pick a new key. So if I hadn't written a song in C lately, then I would just write a song in C. And if I had, yeah. I'd write a song in F, or I'd write a song in, C sharp minor, E major, or something like that. And, but music has always flowed out of me, and songwriting, lyrical writing is something that takes time for me. I can write a piece of music or, a melody or a progression twice a day if I have the time. But lyrics, those are a slow process for me to come up with. And that's just because, this is something I'm going to keep singing and singing. And I want to make sure that whoever is interested in listening and singing along, that it's going to be something that connects them, I guess more so to their own lives and their own experiences. And,
right.
And that's always been, some of my favorite music, not by any means is emo. I was a 90s kid, so the grunge alternative movement was really influential in my life because, it was stopping the 80s hair metal and the Michael Jackson movement from being, center stage in the MTV pop world, and bands like Nirvana and Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains and Soundgarden and Stone Temple Pilots and Rage Against the Machine. All these bands were coming out.
Yeah.
And at the same time, my earliest childhood memory is my mom holding me in her arms, dancing with me to the Thriller record, which came out the year I was born. So I had to have been just, 12 months or younger, this memory that I have. And I was always just raised in a musical home. My dad would sing all the time, was a singer in bands when he was young. My mom played piano and would sit with me at the piano. We'd play like Heart and Soul and Chopsticks when I was really young. But yeah. It was just always, music was always just so important to me that by the time I was writing, it just felt like it was a self-expressive flow that I had to sort of exercise that muscle and get better. But it was going to be happening either way. I just had to learn how to respect it and grow as a songwriter and an artist through it.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that you recorded Destination by yourselves, right? And then you kind of got signed to Tooth & Nail and they put it out. So talk about the process of recording the album and then how you decided did you shop different labels or did Tooth & Nail kind of hear you because of, how did that come to be?
Yeah, so I was going back and forth between Virginia, which is where the band was originally based out of, and Los Angeles. And so I'd spend a few months in L.A., and then I'd come home, and we'd have a month or so before I was required to go back out there. So I would just get into the studio. Our bass player, Mark Padgett, it was his studio, and he had recorded my previous band, and he told me, if you can bear with me and just kind of come in based on like the availability of my schedule, then I'll record you for free. He was young. We were both, 17, 18, 19 at the time. And he needed the experience. And I was just grateful to keep recording music. So we'd hop into his studio like maybe once or twice a month for a long weekend. And it was as experimental as a 19-year-old kid could ever be, because there were no rules, and he was learning. We would track guitars in unconventional ways. We would track drums. I remember we did all of the cymbals separately, which is something that a lot of bands do now. I remember that Queens of the Stone Age record, Songs for the Deaf, that Dave Grohl plays drums on, they recorded the cymbals separately. But I think that we did that before that record was engineered, which doesn't make us pioneers, but we were just forward thinking, just trying to figure out like, well, what can we do to get the most interesting sounds? Well, yeah. if we don't record the cymbals, then we can get the best sounding toms and snare drum and kick drum that we can get. And then we'll do cymbals separately and that'll take some time, but it's all free. And he's learning, Mark is, I'm learning, Jacob's learning. So, it was just like really interesting and backwards because most bands get an opportunity to be quote unquote experimental in a recording setting when they are on a label and they're putting out like their second or their third record or something like that. And this was our first. And it was hodgepodge. It was like, you know, sometimes we would take 3 months before we'd get back in the studio and record for two days.
Yeah.
But, you know, there wasn't really a vision yet because we had never done this before and we didn't know who was going to be interested in what we were doing. But we had our album finished by the time we were playing like our sixth or seventh show. And we were signed to a label, you know, within that month. Huh. So the way our label found us, we would put our music on this website before there was Spotify and YouTube and Facebook and MySpace even. There was this website called mp3.com.
Oh, wow. And, what a great domain.
Right. Back then, especially.
Yeah.
And you could listen to music from other artists and you could create your own profile and upload your own music. And, you know, you could say, hey, we sound like this. So if you're interested in this band, then check us out. And
so similar to Pure Volume.
Exactly.
Okay.
Very much like Pure Volume. And there were charts. So if you were getting streams and downloads, a considerable number, then you would pop up and, you know, be charted and other people could say, oh, well, you know, May, Embers and Envelopes is like one of the top five songs. I'd never heard of this band or this song. I got to check it out.
Yeah.
And that's how our agent, our booking agent, our manager, and our label all found us.
Wow. That's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, it was interesting time back then.
Yeah, for sure.
It's crazy how the stories of how things like that happen have changed so much in the past, like, just 10 years. Seeing how...
Yeah.
It's amazing. So, what were you going to say?
I'd say it's like the essence is the same, but the technology, it continues to change. You know,
right.
Like, YouTube videos might be the way that someone gets discovered these days.
Right.
Or just the right Facebook Live moment at the right time. And,
yeah.
The right
and,
one. Brand
and people
lives
do,
for
like, they peddle, you know, they peddle their music and we were doing that back then. I remember I'd come home from school when I was still going and I would spend 3 hours online just like direct messaging everybody who I could find that had just listened to like a Dashboard Confessional track or a Jimmy Eat World track and be like, hey, if you like those bands, check my band out. And I was really passionate about getting the word out and still so young, but saw the results and it was really exciting.
How did after you guys released that the first album, how was it like touring, and then ultimately how did that turn into the new idea for the project, where you pretty much it's such an awesome record, but it's like this one, I think that it has a lot more of the May multi-aesthetic experience going on with like a storytelling versus the first one. How did that come to be?
Oh, with the Everglow?
Yeah.
With Everglow, right.
Everglow, the story of that really is the experience that we had all through that first year of being a band on the road, playing music all the time, getting better at our instruments and our sound and our relationships with each other. The Everglow is like this story about kind of finding that passion and that dream that you have and seeing it play out into the realities of daily life. And, you know, like I said, when I was in school, I had the support of my family to drop out because I wasn't going there to pursue a career. I was going there because I had graduated from the 12th grade and I guess I was just going to go into the 13th grade, essentially. But by the time I was 21, you know, I was on the road. I would, leave my house in January and come back in June, and my family would fly out to the West Coast to see me, and there was talk of us going overseas, and then, you know, in like February or so of 2004, we're in Japan for the first time performing, and it's just continuing to grow and continuing to grow. And instead of recording an album for free and our bass player's, you know, small little shed studio, we're getting an opportunity to have a budget and to work with a real producer and a real studio. And so I was just so passionate about my passion and seeing it come true. I was really inspired, and I wanted to share that story that the band was experiencing with our audience and let them feel like the freedom to go after what they wanted to be passionate about and turn that into a real lifestyle, maybe a career. That just sort of depends on what we're talking about. But
yeah,
it was because certain stories would continue to be told if we sequenced the album in a specific way. So when we started writing for the Everglow, it wasn't to have this conceptual sort of story book album. But maybe about 75% of the way into the writing and pre-production process, it was clear. It's like, oh, if we start it this way and we keep going, we could just write a couple more songs that will fit in these gaps and we'll have a story. And I remember at this point, too, talking about technology and how much it's changed. Album sales were really important, and the only way that you were getting music digitally is if you were going to, what are those sites now? Like, basically, where you can illegally download music?
Yeah.
The torrent sites?
Yeah, BitTorrent sites. So I remember a lot of my friends in bands at that time were putting out records, and they were getting bummed out because these records would show up on these BitTorrent sites, and it would sort of diminish the day of the release excitement. Yeah. And so I was a little crafty, and I was like, well, that's going to happen. But if we keep going in this direction where we have this prologue and this epilogue, and it's a story, and there's going to be artwork for each song, you can find the record on a BitTorrent website, no problem, but you're never going to have the same experience that you'll have if you get the record for the fullest extent of the experience that we're trying to create and give.
Yeah.
And it worked. So some of it was like a way to stay ahead of the curve. Some of it was just a way to tell the story the best way that, you know, at this point I'm 22, 23 years old. Still very young, but gaining more and more confidence in my ability to songwrite and songwrite with my bandmates and tell the story that, you know, I and we felt like convicted to tell. But it was a combination of the experiences we were having being in the music industry and just the passion that was continuing to grow and be nurtured because we were a band, quote unquote, making it.
Yeah. The album is so good musically, especially. Like, there's so many little, like, just things throughout the album that when I hear it, I get really excited. Like, not even like lyrically, like just musically. Like, I was telling a buddy that I was interviewing you guys, and he was like, is that the band that goes da 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 da? And I'm like, yeah, that's the one. Like, it's just a thing. So it's just interesting. Like, that album, for whatever reason, has so many little things musically that people have stuck with them. Right. Have you seen that as you guys continue to play these songs and also people just talk to you about it, I'm sure. Do you feel like musically people have really been, I don't know, just attracted to it musically more so than any other thing that you guys have put out? Or is it kind of just another thing for you guys?
Well, we did celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Everglow's release last year, and we did a full U.S. tour playing that album from start to finish,
which I missed, and I was super, super pissed.
So did I. That was the worst, man. I was so close to getting into that.
Oh no. Well, that was definitely my favorite touring experience ever.
Yeah.
for a number of different reasons. I wrote that record with my band when I was, 21, 22, and I didn't have the foresight by any means. I don't think most people do, especially early in a career, to think, wow, 10 years will pass and people will still care about this record and it will still be meaningful in such a way where they will want to come out in droves and like celebrate this anniversary with us. I mean, the shows were almost completely sold out and we had these meet and greets every night where people would come, they buy an additional ticket to just either hang out with us or we'd play an acoustic show playing songs we weren't going to play that night. And, we meet these people who walk down the aisle, these couples who walk down the aisle to one of these songs or, we didn't bring her, but our little daughter May is at home right now at the babysitter, and of course we named her after your band. And and then some of the stories were just incredible, like addictions that were sort of cured because of as they would say, just finding hope in our music. Or there's a song on the Everglow called "Mistakes We Knew We Were Making," and it's about a couple having a baby unexpectedly. And in Atlanta, I remember this so clearly. This girl comes up to me, and she still looks so young. She's like, "I got pregnant when I was 16, and I'm so excited to tell you that the father of the child and I are getting married." And it's like, so this happened now like 9 years ago, and now at this point it'd be 10 years ago, but back during the tours 9 years ago.
Yeah.
And she was just crying. She was just so happy and grateful that she got to tell me that story. And it's like, I'm 21 years old, just traveling around in a van, writing songs, on off days and during sound checks and in between tours, just trying to fill in gaps to put out another record of music that's definitely important to me. But once it gets out there, it's no longer mine. It's no longer ours. It's our listeners. And when I find a new record that I love, I might think for a time or two, like, oh, I wonder what the song's about from the perspective of the writer or the artist. And right. Most of the time, it's just for me. I find ways to make that music a soundtrack for my life. And so when it comes to the appreciation of our music, all I can say is that I'm incredibly grateful, and I wish for one day I could, stand in the crowd at a May show, or I could listen to the record like I had never written that riff 9 different ways before deciding which one was the right one to go with.
Right.
But that's the blessing and the curse of doing this thing, is that, I analyze this music, and I've never been by any means 100% satisfied with a May recording, because I'm so intimately involved and know where every kick placement is, and know when that weird sound swells up and what we did to get that, where I'm no longer able to think, I guess, really big picture.
Right.
Sometimes I'll listen to a record like a year or two later, and I'll be far enough removed from it where I can distance myself from it, but I get critical almost immediately. So, but to say, all I can say is how overwhelmingly humbling it is to have people that care about our music enough to know the melodies and to know the lyrics. And, like you said, you guys covered a May song. That's, doesn't matter to me how bad or how good it was. It's just like really amazing for me to know that people are learning our songs, because they want to perform music live, and that's like the way to do it.
Sure. You're too kind. You don't have to be flattered. and kind of a follow-up to that, I feel like a lot of bands are doing these album, like 10-year anniversary tours and stuff like that for albums that were like maybe a little bit bigger than their other ones. As somebody who's recorded a few albums and loves them all differently, is it weird or frustrating at times that people might love one album more than the others, or is that kind of just come with the territory and you get that?
Yeah, I think it just comes with the territory. I know I just had this conversation with a producer friend of mine, that my favorite bands always continue to grow musically, lyrically.
Yep.
They continue to learn what they don't know. They continue to push their own boundaries, even to the point of it being uncomfortable. And sometimes you have to, like, I'll write a riff in my mind that my fingers can't play on the guitar. So I need to get into a practice space and just work on my dexterity, you know? And I need to, like, I want a guitar riff that is more, it doesn't have to be more complex. It just has to be more expressive than what I've done before. And once I get to that point, you know, eventually that guitar riff becomes pretty easy to play, but it takes some time. That's, I think that's why I was writing songs in different keys when I was younger too. It's just like, well, I've kind of figured my way around D and B minor for, you know, this little season of my life. Let me figure out F now.
Right.
And so, you know, different songs mean more to me on my favorite band's albums than other songs, other records, other times. Like, I'm a huge Death Cab for Cutie fan, and
right.
Plans or Transatlanticism, which, you know, those records came out like in 2003 and 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those songs tend to last more sort of in the story of my life than, say, some of their newer songs, but I'm always getting that new Death Cab record, you know,
no
the
doubt.
Day it comes out, and waiting and anticipating that they're gonna sort of fulfill my musical needs, and they always do. And so, someone who might be a May fan that's kind of like holding on to an older record, I get it. And I'd say at the same time, if you're willing to keep following where we're headed, and we'll do our very best to keep giving you the essence of May, I guess.
Sure.
Like we just were saying, Everglow did super well because of you guys creating that something that couldn't be fully captured in a download illegally. That was kind of an awesome thing that it then produced such a success with it. How did that kind of led you guys then to get signed to Capitol? So what was it like going from independent to minor to a major label? How did that affect you guys creatively and kind of the atmosphere of the band?
That was truly the darkest and most confusing season,
really,
for all of us in May. And you know, speaking sometimes on behalf of, at this point we were still a 5-member band, and then just kind of speaking on behalf of myself, it became very blurred vision as far as how we were going about creating or continuing to promote our brand. And we didn't say, like, when we were coming up with the name May, Multisensory Aesthetic Experience, like, this is for the sake of our brand, you know? We were just passionate about what we were passionate about, and that turned into Destination Beautiful. That turned into the Everglow. Now it's like we got these suits who pick us up and take us out for dinner and drop, you know, $1,500 on a meal and wine and stuff. And and we're all just kind of thinking, like, well, they're expecting us to make this money back. So I'll send some demos, and I'll get on a call with our manager and with our A&R, and they'll say, well, we really like this, but we feel like the chorus could be stronger. And it's not like working with you know, someone in my band or some other musician where they're like, hey, so what chords are you playing? Like, what do you think about this chord? It's more like, you need to make it better. We yeah. don't have any suggestions for you. We're not musical. Go make it better.
Mm.
And it's like, wow.
Oh, boy.
Why am I pleasing or trying to please these people? It's like, well, because they are funding the season of my lifestyle right now. And it got really, really confusing as to why music was being written. Like, I went through a severe writer's block during, like, the season in between The Everglow and Singularity. And so I wrote less on that record than anything else I've ever written on. Hmm. And it was because I was sort of terrified. I was terrified of failing. I was concerned that, you know, like my bandmates and I, we were trying to also do things like get married and buy houses and accept more American responsibility. And and with that, you know, the only way I was making money in my life was through writing music, playing music, producing music. And if that were to go away, I didn't have a plan B. Right. And when I didn't have a plan B and I was 20, I had reckless abandon for May. And now, if I didn't have a plan B, I felt like I felt just terrified of the future.
Mm.
And so walking into that experience, you know, it was more fear-based, which is terrible. I think you can write some beautiful music out of discomfort and sadness and anger and fear. But if that is coming from the people who are paying for your record to come out, essentially, that's not nearly as healthy as like some of those other kind of dark places that you might find yourself in. And
sure.
And because the band was growing, you know, we were no longer touring in a van making $100 a night. We were touring in a bus making good money. We were comfortable to a place where we weren't enjoying our relationships with each other as much. Mm. And so that made writing harder. It made collaboration a little more difficult. And I think we're just sort of in awe of the moment, and it kind of took us over, and then we were in fear of the moment.
Yeah.
And so that period, even though it did have a lot of really amazing opportunities and experiences, you know, on the other side of that, the wake of that was us losing two members and us getting off of Capitol Records and us parting ways with our management. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of death on the other side of Singularity that I don't know if Singularity was the catalyst for it or if we were the catalyst for Singularity. I think it's kind of hard to figure out where one starts and the other one stops. But that experience for me, and I do believe for all of us, it made so like a purge was necessary and there to be a cleanse for us to get ourselves over to that morning, afternoon, and evening side and kind of going past Singularity into morning, afternoon, and evening. You know, I feel like most of the songs on Singularity are like 3.5 minutes long, where probably on average a song on morning, afternoon, or evening is like 5 minutes long. And
right.
It's like we were trying to get back to that self-expressive, creative, let this thing breathe and not dissect it and cut all the pieces out before we even know what's good about it.
Yeah.
We had to do that. So that's part of the reason why there's a lot of experimentation on the other side of Singularity, because we felt like we didn't have the freedom to do what May fans loved about us and that we loved about ourselves, was like we were a self-expressive, emotive, melodic band And mm-hmm. now we're sort of like being told, write more hooks,
yeah.
make the chorus stronger.
Yeah.
Don't spend so much time in the verse. Don't make these intros long. You know, it's like, whoa, whoa, these are the things that are sort of pillars of our sound. And so we lost that during that season, I feel.
Yeah. So you kind of mentioned earlier that, you know, Capitol kind of threw, you guys went from recording an album for free and then for just a little bit to an $800,000 record with a lot of pressure on you. Is it possible for a band to create pure, honest, and still really good musical and true to themselves music when there's that much money and that much pressure on the line? Or do you feel like it just kind of skews music as a whole when there's that much money and stuff on the line with a release?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know that, you know, I live in Nashville now, and I'm talking to you from my studio, and I know that a bigger budget is going to allow me to spend more time with an artist or a band. It's going to allow me to the opportunity to grab more gear or outside musicians. You know, if the band I'm working with wants strings on a few of their songs and they want these, you know, like lush arrangements, I can, if I have money, more so, you know, if I have more, like a bigger budget to work with, it allows me to spend more time arranging strings, finding the players in town, getting the best results. So there might be more of a purity attached to writing music without the expectation of what's going to happen with it. I do feel like, you know, if you give me, I don't know, say you give me a $15,000 budget to make a record, or you give me a $30,000 budget to make a record, I know that I'll be able to take that extra money and possibly do something really great with it. And it really depends on the project. It depends on the songwriters,
right,
the singers, the instruments. You know, like if we're just like doing some acoustic stuff in a room, you don't really need that kind of budget. If you're going to go all out and try, you know, kind of messing in some engineering ways that are, you know, unfamiliar, and you're going to try miking this differently, and you're really going to want to make this song kind of do this specific thing, and it's going to take time and energy and money, then I get it. But I just don't think that the motivation should ever be money.
Sure.
When it comes to song writing. Now, I also work for a company based out of L.A. Where I score for film and television and commercials.
Oh, wow.
And that's a totally different thing. I'll get an email and it'll say, you know, this company is looking for a 30-second musical piece that sounds like this. And they'll, you know, they'll attach some YouTube clips or whatever. And I'll listen to that, and then I'll just come up with something that is true to me but is based on the influence of this particular email. And of course, if you win it, there's money to be made, and and I can get into that world, and that's fun, and that's kind of like going to school and having homework that you have
sure.
to do. And the turnaround time for that is always like one day, or like at the most 3 days. If they give it to you on a Friday, they'll be like, well, it's due Monday. But otherwise, it's like, if I got one right now, it'd be due like maybe at the end of the day today or by tomorrow. Now, I can get into that because it's a challenge, but that only makes my songwriting more sacred.
Sure.
You know, it's like I can separate those two. And also it allows me to like accept that challenge. I've been playing music now for well over 20 years, not professionally, but 15 almost years I've been playing professionally. And this is just a way to keep my chops up and keep me coming into the studio in the gaps where there isn't like a May song to work on or a band or an artist that I'm producing. And so I feel like we all have to make money to live. And it really is nice when what you love doing is also the way that you pay your bills and put money into a savings account and, you know, start a family or whatever it is that, you know, you want to do apart from just your career. But I do think that when the pressure of the label is more than just suggestive, right? It's like you are telling me that this chorus needs to be stronger. Mm-hmm. And you're not giving me any insight. And I don't really, and I mean this humbly, but I don't respect your insight because I know that you're not a musician.
Right.
And so there isn't like this collaborative thing that we're able to do together. You give me in the room with the producer, and the producer says, I think like this chorus needs to be stronger. Then I know that that person is consistently working with music and crafting music. So I'll ask specific questions and get specific answers that'll help me kind of grow that chorus or that verse or whatever. And so I'm getting a little long-winded about it, but I think always my favorite songs I've ever written have come from that purity of writing for myself and knowing now that other people are going to hear it. So how can I provide, you know, a moment musically for somebody who might need this?
Yeah. So kind of just as to tie up Singularity, as you look back at that and knowing that it came out of a place of pressure and being in writer's block and also some discord between the band, as you look back at that album, how do you feel about it as a whole and as a part of the May collection of albums?
It is, I don't know, maybe I should like go to therapy and listen to the record.
This is it, actually. This is therapy.
It might be, because yeah. if you saw us live on that Everglow tour, we did play extra music, but we only played, we did play sometimes two songs from Singularity. I know that was the focus of that tour was the Everglow. But if you go to like our previous tours, and we have to go back pretty far because the band's been on a hiatus for some time now. But, you know, if you were to look at a set list of 15 songs, maybe two or three of them were Singularity songs.
Mm-hmm.
But the band's been around for a while now, and we've got a lot of music. So it's easy to just put a set list together and miss Singularity as like a common thread through the set list because we've got a lot of music, because our fans would, you know, I would guess if you were to poll 1,000 May fans, I would think like 60% would say the Everglow is their favorite record, and then maybe Destination Beautiful or Morning, Afternoon, and Evening would be after that.
Uh-huh.
So it's easy to sort of like kind of put it under a rock when it didn't live up to what our fans wanted as well as what we wanted.
Sure.
Almost to sort of dismiss it. But I feel like if I spent a little season and I listened to Singularity, you know, once a week or whatever, and journaled, and I'm being serious here, to like,
yeah,
I would be able to flush out like some of that confusion that kind of stuck around, because like I said, it was really a dark place. Yeah. I mean, our band sort of broke up because of that record, and those months when it was just the three of us, but we hadn't like written new music yet, and we hadn't, you know, figured out what the new goal was. Like, that was a really, really confusing time.
Yeah.
And now that, you know, that was now like 7-8 years ago.
Yeah.
It was longer than that. It came out in 07, so it's like almost 9 years ago now.
Mm.
But yeah, I think I still need a little bit of clarity when it comes to what the reasoning behind that season for all of us in May was worth.
Yeah. So listen to it for the next month, journal for the next month. We'll have you on again right before Christmas. We'll talk through it together. It'll be a great time.
I'll be sobbing the whole time.
Yeah. It'll be good.
Yeah. Maybe.
It's weird how music will do that. Like we were discussing earlier, it's got such a power over the thoughts that we have and stuff like that, just the way it gets into your brain. So for me, anything that I've ever made, when I listen to it, it just has so much attached to it, more so than like listening to something somebody else made. And for you to have a whole album that way that has so much attached to it, I can't even imagine. Like you said, you hear each individual sound, and then you can think of that sound and remember when you were pushing the button that made that sound, or when you were hitting the kick or whatever it is. It's just so weird how that'll seep in there.
Well, what's also so interesting about that is, like, you know, I work in a studio all the time, and my colleagues will talk about Singularity because that was produced by Howard Benson. It was mixed by Tom Lord Alge. We spent, you know, $800,000 making that record, mm-hmm. and so it sounds pretty freaking good.
Yeah.
So it's one thing to be like, you know, analyzing the tones and stuff, like, man, this mix is really incredible, and then be like, yeah, but the song, I'm not really sure if I even feel like it came from me because it changed so much from when I wrote it to, you know, this version that you're familiar with. Mm. But I really do love, honestly, getting opportunities to spend that much time on guitar tones and have Tom Lord Alge mix our album and stuff like that. So there's certain things, you know, even still, like, I am proud of, but I almost listen to it. Like I said earlier, if I could be like outside of May for a day, I think the closest I've ever gotten is the whole Singularity experience. I'm on the brink of disaster.
So now you guys kind of briefly touched on this when we were talking about it earlier. So you guys have that moment where you're going to break, that you kind of have the kind of downfall there. So how did that turn into these three EPs, and how did you guys, what was your mindset knowing that you were going to do a kind of final tour setup mm-hmm. before you went on the hiatus? What was kind of going through everybody's minds at that point?
Well, so we released a song every month in 2009.
I love that. That was so fun.
It was great for us. You know, and you look at like where the industry was at that time, where technology was at that time. Album sales were decreasing. First week album sales were reducing in number, and this was a way for us to not only redefine success for ourselves, reach back into the community of people who had supported us for all of these years and impact them. But it was a way for us to stay relevant all year long. Everybody was expecting there to be a new May song every month. Hmm. And so we've always been creative about the unveiling of something from May, you know, making sure that as a business decision, it's as creative and as impactful as it is a piece of art. And so that season was a lot of fun. I mean, we had recorded a lot of that music ahead of time, so it was easy for us to, you know, put out a song once a month because we had done our work prior to. But then not everything was finished on January 1 by any means. So we'd be in the studio like around April 1st or whatever, finishing up the morning EP because we had to be on the road in like 16 days playing the first show, and we needed to hurry up and mix it, hurry up and master it, send it to the plant to get, you know, 2,500 CDs made so they would be at the first show when we started tour. So we had set ourselves up for a lot of hard work and like the redefinition of success. And it was a lot of fun. Musically, we were expressing ourselves in a new way. The sound of the band started to change because we had to adapt to no longer being a five piece, but a three piece.
Mm-hmm.
I started playing a lot of keys, and I had played keys in this band Kenna when I was 19, but Rob, our keys player, was so good that there was no need for me to ever touch a keyboard anymore. And so that was both really like intimidating.
Yeah, I didn't realize that those were your keys key parts in those EPs. Like, there's some really good keys in the those EPs.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, I didn't
realize that. We share the load, and we also did bring in some other musicians to come in and play like some strings and some key stuff and flute and horns and some things like that. But that was for me such a growing period musically. I would write and write and write and write, and I was then taking the singularity sort of you need to keep writing. Like mantra that was kept coming at me, mm-hmm. and I turned it into something better. And I was like, well, okay, I want to make sure that people get those experiences that they had during the Everglow and during our live shows, you know, in that era. And I want it to be something that is fresh for me and for us musically with our songwriting. And I don't want to be limited by like what I know. I want to keep growing and figure out what the next May is going to sound like. And it was just so rewarding that season. And of course the work was so hard. Like I said, we didn't have a label anymore. We didn't have a manager anymore. And we were supplementing on our own those roles. And so certain things we'd have to spread ourselves incredibly thin, but I'm morning, afternoon and evening up until this new May music comes out. I'm most proud of that. It's been years and years since these songs have been recorded and written, but since it was the last thing that May put out and there was such a purity that came back to the songwriting and to just the essence of who May was and what we were trying to accomplish and where our gratitude was at that moment and how we were expressing ourselves through that gratitude. Morning, afternoon, and evening are by far like my proudest May moments. As far as recordings go,
right?
That'll change soon because there's new May music coming. Very soon.
Great.
But that season. To get back to like trying to fully answer your question, we planned out a lot of it, knowing that we could get the three member band to be a five member band for a goodbye, goodnight hiatus announcement tour. That was really nice too, because we had like found ourselves as a three piece, and yet we could go back to the five member band. The relationships had healed and things
That's
had changed.
Awesome.
And for morning, afternoon, and evening to turn into goodbye, goodnight, that's the therapy at the time that we all needed. And we all dove in headfirst to make sure that, you know, we stayed in that water until it was fully cleansing. And it was.
Yeah.
And so, at that time, I wasn't even friends with our keyboard player, Rob. And Rob put out a record a couple years ago of solo stuff, and he came out to Nashville and I produced it. And so, you know, it took like, a rekindling and a complete cleansing and then a renewal that morning, afternoon, evening did for me and for Zach and for Jacob. And then when Mark and Rob came back for the Goodbye, Goodnight tour, it just kept purifying the whole band and the whole, you know, dynamic of our relationships and our musicality, et cetera.
Sure. So that's kind of got us to where we are now. You guys are kind of starting to make some music again. You're playing shows here and there, and you're doing this virtual reality thing with a few shows here and there. So talk about that, because I feel like that's kind of the whole multi-sensory thing, like, really played out to the fullest. So talk about what you guys are shooting to do there, if that's going to be like a nationwide type thing or just here and there. And then also when we can hope we will hear some new May music.
Yes. Thank you for asking. May became the first band ever to perform a synced live virtual reality concert experience. So we were in Israel, in Jerusalem, at the Tower of David back in early April of this year. We wrote an instrumental musical piece with our friend Tim Fain, who's like a world-renowned violinist. And you put your smartphone, you go to a website, put your smartphone in a VR viewfinder, whether it be just like a sort
Google Glass.
Cheaper, yeah, Google Glass, cardboard, you know, you can get like a nice or like a higher end version if you want to, but we control it. So basically you just put it on your face and you start watching and it's all correlating to the music. You know, when the bass comes in, something new shows up, and as the dynamic builds, the VR experience, it's an abstract art experience. The song's called Light, but we were the first band to perform that synced virtual reality concert experience. We did it in New York City a few times at this event called The Future of Storytelling, which is like a summit and festival kind of curating and collecting all of the artists in every space, whether it be virtual reality, photography, videography, dance, theater, traditional music, unconventional, experiential, or experimental music, all the above. So it was an honor to be invited to be a part of that. And so what we've been doing lately is like multi-sensory aesthetic experience to the fullest, almost to where it's disconnecting us from like the history of the band, which would be the band that you'd see open up for the Foo Fighters and Weezer or go on a club tour, you know, in the States. Like this is like us kind of finding our other identity. And now what we're trying to do is blend these two worlds together, because we have been multi-sensory aesthetic experience since 2001. Mm-hmm. But like you asked earlier, there were years where the band was May and we didn't really want to call ourselves multi-sensory aesthetic experience because we couldn't provide one for you with the like with the assets or, you know, like the ingredients that were available to us at that time. So now we've really been making friends in this art community and have done it all DIY. And now we're trying to do it with a greater production. When you talk about like, does money kind of mess up the creative experience? Well, in this case, no, it won't, because we'll do our part, you know, musically. I don't need a lot of money to make May music, but if we're going to have a virtual reality experience or a story or something that goes alongside of a brand new May song, I want it to be amazing.
Right.
And that's where you kind of have to chase down the artists and find out what their budgets are and be accommodating to their needs and their wants, et cetera. So we're doing some club shows in January. We just announced that we're playing Indonesia next month. I'll be traveling overseas with the guys to to do a show out there. We, like I said, we just played New York City about 4 weeks ago, 3 or 4 weeks ago. We're playing New York, New Jersey, and Philadelphia in January, and I know that there will be more and more and more May shows in 2017 because there will be more and more and more May music. And instead of just giving you some abstract virtual reality art instrumental piece, I've been writing music practically every day for years. But when it comes to putting on the May hat and wear that flag, it's been so long that I'm taking almost more, there's a lot of pressure, and I don't want to let anybody down. I don't want to let myself down. And it's really because I've grown so much as a musician and a producer and an engineer here in Nashville over the last 5 years that I want to make sure that what we're putting out is the best content we ever have. But I've been working literally for on and off for about 2 years on new May music, and there is a lot of it. And we're in this weird place where we've been, you know, we made our first record for free, and then we licensed it to Tooth & Nail, and then Tooth & Nail gave us a budget, and we put out the Everglow, and then Capitol gave us a huge budget, and we put out Singularity. Then we went independent and started our own label and did everything on our own for morning, afternoon, and evening. And we've experienced like almost the entirety of the gamut. Like we've done it by ourselves. We've done it where people, you know, give us money and tell us, you know, what they think is best. And we've done it sort of in the middle too. So we're going to make sure that we've got plenty of finished music where no one can really tell us how to make it better. if we don't want that, I mean, we're always down to work with another producer or to collaborate. with other musicians and artists. That's a fact. But we don't want the industry or the business to dictate our art. And
sure.
we've been a band long enough to where that doesn't even need to factor in. So we're also taking meetings with labels and management and stuff like that these days, showing them the music to see how we can best release this music the way that will get us, I guess, the greatest audience potential, because I'm really, really proud of the songs and the production and the arrangements and the engineering and everything. And I don't want it just to reach May fans, because I feel like people who don't know who the band is would be really intrigued by what we're doing. And,
awesome.
And the songs and the music will speak to these people. And so that's the long answer of where we're at. The VR game, the virtual reality game, is really interesting because, you know, I'm used to eye contact with the audience and
right.
Singing and hearing the lyrics, you know, sung back to me. And now I'm looking into a crowd where everybody's got a viewfinder on their faces and they're just like turning around 360 degrees, you know, just kind of taking in the moment. And I don't want to get too far away from that, because I do love that aspect of community when we're all in the room singing together, and the audience member to other audience member relationship that happens during that night. And of course the band member to band member relationship that flourishes during that experience, and then band member to audience and so on. And so like, I'm sort of, I wouldn't say I'm skeptical of, well, I am, I'm skeptical of VR long-term, but it's something that is really helping us tell more of our multi-sensory aesthetic experience story. And so we're gonna chase it a little bit and see what we can do. But I feel like there'll be a May song to come out very soon. And of course, by the time we're playing shows in January, we want to have at least one new song out there available for people to hear, because we're going to want to play it live. And I'm hoping that there's a virtual reality experience to accompany that new song.
Great.
That's awesome. I actually was able to go to the New York one, because I live in New York. And my girlfriend was part of the PR team at the Future Storytelling, and that was so cool. It was super cool.
Oh, great. Cool. Awesome. Thank you very much. I'm glad you got to experience it. It's so rare, because there are even the most diehard May fans that follow us, you know, even when we're taking 3 years off, that are just kind of watching what we're doing, and they have no idea what that experience is like yet. So it's very
awesome.
Rare.
I'm so excited. It's
oh, good.
It was just like, it's just such a unique thing. I've never had that experience before. To just like, it also was cool because everybody just got the little cardboard piece and then stuck their phone, and it was so easy for every single person in the whole entire place to be able to access it.
That's what we're trying to figure out too, is if we're going to give people this experience, you know, in a club show in like Manhattan, how do we make sure that no one is left behind? Because at this point, if you have an old phone, it's not going to work. If the Wi-Fi is not strong enough, then you know, everybody can't connect to it. So there are specific technological details that have nothing to do with tuning guitars or, you know, sound checks and stuff that we're we're taking on the responsibility of for right now. But we're trying to get it to a place where the people who are used to focusing on these kind of details do that for us, and we just work on the music and the performance, and there's the synergy that develops.
Awesome.
We're trying to figure that out completely right now.
Right. Well, hopefully when you come in January, Brian, he lives in South Carolina, but I'll make him come up, and then we'll go and see how things are going with that.
Dude, I'm so excited for new music. Like, even that short, one minute, 30 second thing you posted a couple weeks ago, like, got me really pumped up. Like, just the instrumental part of it was great. So I'm excited. We'll have to have you back on once you release it and break down all the tracks and musically and stuff like that, because I think it's going to be great. I'm excited.
Oh, that's great. Thanks for saying that, man. I'm so excited for new May music. And
we all are.
I feel like once this music comes out, like there is an identity of May that people have maybe considered but haven't really understood that we're finally able to convey. Yeah. And that's just because we've grown as musicians and songwriters and engineers, producers, and the music that will come out here very soon will be, I believe, the best May music to date.
Yeah, great. Looking forward to it. We will point people in your direction once it comes out and hope to chat with you afterwards, all right?
Awesome.
Great, right. Thanks, man. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, man.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.